Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Folks, I am so excited to bring this individual on. It has been a long time coming, and it's my honor to introduce him to you. Andrew L. Seidel is a constitutional attorney and the director of strategic response at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the FFRF. He's won numerous academic awards and holds two law degrees, a JD magna cum laude from Tulane University Law School and an LLM from Denver University's Sturm College of Law. Andrew has a BS. I am full of BS, but it's a completely different type of BS that Andrew has. He has a BS in neuroscience and environmental studies from Tulane. He has also appeared on Fox News to debate Bill O'Reilly himself, MSNBC, and hundreds of other media outlets on behalf of FFRF. Before dedicating his life and law degree to keeping state and church separate, Andrew was a Grand Canyon tour guide and an accomplished nature photographer. His first book, which is what we're going to be kind of talking about today, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, was burned by a Tennessee preacher. And his second book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom, is coming out next year, 2022. Andrew, welcome. I'm so glad you're here today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me on. I love what RFRF does. I think you guys fill such an important niche. You know, you build this community and this support system for people. So if anybody is out there considering volunteering, I really hope they go sign up.
Thanks for that plug. Appreciate it. You know, before we get on with our discussion, can you tell us a little bit about your Grand Canyon tour guide years?
Yeah,
that sounds freaking fascinating.
Oh man, it was the best. I really loved it. So, and this is actually one of the things that convinced me to go to law school in the first place was I got really into environmental protection. I was always into camping and hiking and being outside and nature photography, but there's nothing like the Grand Canyon. Actually, my desktop photo is one of my photos that I've taken from the Grand Canyon as well. So many fantastic memories. I've seen the canyon just about every possible way you can. You know, and you want to talk about like really amazing experiences. You know, you talk about that numinous, that feeling of wow, that you get that at the Grand Canyon. Like there's several spots. There's a couple of layers in the canyon where essentially you had this very old rock layer that tons of new layers laid down on top of it, and they all washed away, and then new layers got put down. So there's this spot called Great Unconformity. And you can place your hand, and you can place your hand between these two layers of rock, and you're spanning a billion years of the Earth's history.
Jeez.
And I mean, that is like one of the coolest, and like standing there knowing that your hand is spanning a billion years is just, it really is an amazing experience, and you know, completely devoid of anything divine, but still very much in the numinous realm.
Yeah. I was really lucky enough to take a rafting trip down the Colorado River.
Oh, nice.
Through the Grand Canyon with my wife. It was something I'll never forget, and just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. I know how lucky I am because not a whole lot of people are able to do that. And it was like an auction that we won.
Oh wow, yeah. If you can do it, that is the way to see it. I mean, I think that's where you see all the really cool, interesting stuff. And people don't realize how different it is. You know, I went on a hike one day and I left the rim and it was snowing, and you go a vertical mile, and by the time I got down to the bottom and it was 2 p.m., you know, it was 98 degrees when I was down there. It's crazy.
Jeez. Yeah. Wow. The amazing thing too is like just not only the deep time and the geology. I know we're going off.
Let's geology do it. And
but not only the deep time with geology, but there are human imprints there too.
Yeah.
Humans have made their mark on there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. We got to see where the indigenous people would have chewed up some red dirt or plant and then put their hand on a rock and spit mm-hmm. against it. It's almost like their signature. Yeah. It was just fascinating out there. Oh, Andrew, I got to see one of the pink rattlesnakes too. I got to see one of those out there.
The Grand Canyon rattlesnake?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's cool. Oh. That's really rare. I've only saw one once. I was rock climbing actually, and I pulled myself up over a ledge. And he was right there and his little rattle went up. You know, they're not big and they really are beautiful though. They're so beautiful. I'm glad you got to see that. That's really, that's a rare opportunity.
I was in a pool, just kind of standing in a pool. I turn over and like 3 feet away is this gorgeous, like light red snake and looked like, I'm like, oh, I'm a little,
let me tell my favorite animal story and then I'll let you take us wherever else you want to go. They have California condors in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
This is like one of the few places in the world where they exist. And these birds are enormous. They have a 9.5 foot wingspan. And when I was there, the populations recovered somewhat, but there was just over 200 of them left. And this was a really cool experience to be able to see them. And I actually hiked up the Little Colorado River, which is a tributary of the Big Colorado. And I just strapped the life jacket on. And I was just floating down the river. And it's this nice, warm, electric blue water because it carves through the limestone rock and it picks up all this calcium carbonate. And it's this beautiful, crazy blue that doesn't seem real. And it's warm because it's going through the desert. And I was just had my eyes closed and I was just lying there enjoying this moment. And then a shadow just kind of goes between me and the sun. And a condor had spotted me and thought I was dead meat. And the condor is like, ooh, a meal, yay. And so I just laid there chilling and it kept circling and getting lower and lower and lower until it was about maybe 6 feet above me. And I could tell it was about to come in for a landing on its next pass. So then I stopped and I stood up and I was like, I'm not dead, please keep your distance. But it was, I mean, it's so cool. These things are so prehistoric looking and amazing. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Well, I got to say, I'm with the bird. Andrew, you look super delicious to me. So.
Hopefully and not I'm, like rotting carrion though. No. I mean, they're,
so. Trent, I'm so sorry for monopolizing the conversation here.
I'm thoroughly enjoying the notion of Andrew being rotting carrion. So be my guest.
Well, let's kind of kick this conversation off. Andrew, you wrote the Founding Myth book, and it was just I remember when it came out and so many people were really excited about it and just a brilliant work. What, let's kind of start at the beginning. What precipitated your desire to write this book? What was the triggering moment?
You know, it wasn't really one moment for me. It was kind of a long process. It actually, I mean, you know, really start to finish, it almost took a decade. I was reading in law school. I was reading cases. This is what you do when you're a young lawyer learning to be a lawyer. And I remember reading a couple of the Supreme Court justices, Scalia specifically, say, well, obviously our laws are based on the Ten Commandments. And I thought to myself, well, that's not right. Like I've read the Ten Commandments and I can see why you might see some similarities, but that's definitely not right. And so I thought, you know, this would be really interesting to do as a law review. And I'll compare the Ten Commandments to the Ten Amendments to our Bill of Rights. And then I started thinking about it a little more. I'm like, that's actually not going to work because there's the analog's not perfect there. But I can definitely compare the Ten Commandments to American law and see what it looks like. And this will be a great law review. And it turns out like it got away from me real, real fast. Like there's a lot more content there than I realized. So, I mean, very quickly it became clear that there was something more here. And the more I wrote and the more I researched and the more I had these arguments, you know, and a lot of the polling questions kind of go to the arguments that I heard over the years of having this debate with people as I was writing this, the more I realized it needed to be something more, something bigger. And then after Susan Jacoby, who's written a number of just amazing books, I had the pleasure of meeting her and chatting with her, and I was talking with her about writing, and she asked about it and eventually read it and said, look, you really got to do something bigger than you're even thinking with this. This is a book. You need to get an agent. You need to get a publisher. I'm going to help you do that. I'll write the foreword for you. And she did all that. I mean, she was really just a huge, huge influence on me in this book. And, you know, I still send her a bottle of whiskey every year as a thank you. She's just a really fantastic, amazing, selfless person. She's been a huge help to me in my writing career.
And this, the book, even though it was a 10-year process, the book was published at a very, very timely part in U.S. history, mm-hmm. and or a time in U.S. history. And it was during the Trump presidency, and how it just was craziness. And Christian nationalism seemed to be not only on the rise, but out there and exposed for everyone to see. Would you do us a favor and kind of define what Christian nationalism is?
Yeah. First, just let me touch on that point, because you're right. It came along about the Christian nationalism is what put Donald Trump in office. Mm-hmm. We've seen waves of Christian nationalism throughout American history, where Christian nationalists have seized power and they've imposed their will on the country. And I talk about those waves in the book. You know, during the Civil War, the 1950s, we saw them, and Trump recognized, maybe not consciously, that there was another coming wave of Christian nationalism, and he tapped into that undercurrent in a way that nobody was prepared for. And actually, the best predictor of a Trump voter in the 2016 election was thinking that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. That was the best way to predict whether or not somebody would vote for Trump. But what is Christian nationalism? That's what you asked. Christian nationalism is the idea that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, that we are based on Judeo-Christian principles, but most importantly, this really is the most important, that we've strayed from that foundation, that we have gotten away from those godly roots. And I mean, they love the language of return, right? They yearn for this golden past. And really what they're doing is they're claiming to be the true heirs of the American experiment.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
And more importantly, really the American identity. So they're the true Americans, TM. And everybody else, you're just an interloper, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that really is and they use the language of return too to justify all this hateful public policy from the Trump administration. I think people forget this, right? The Muslim ban was largely a Christian nationalist push. Not only did it ban Muslims from immigrants from Muslim majority countries, it also favored immigration for Christians from those same countries. This was explicitly Christian nationalist. The child separation policy at the border, right? Attorney General Jeff Sessions justified that by citing the Bible. So did Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Whoa.
And he learned to do that in the White House Bible study. I think other people are more familiar with the opposition to gay marriage. The opposition to LGBTQ rights and equality is almost exclusively Christian nationalist at this point. I think the thing that is really important to take away, and what I did differently in the founding myth than what had been done in the past, is that Christian nationalism is not a scholarly debate about American history. It's a sinister, exclusionary movement. It's a debate about who we are as a people right now. And Christian nationalists are attempting to redefine America according to their identity and the disinformation that shapes their identity, and then reshape our law accordingly. The goal is to make it so that to be an American is to be a Christian, and to be a Christian is to be an American.
You know, the thought that immediately comes to my mind is what would this idea of America being a Christian nation, how would this be different than, say, a country like Iraq or a country like Saudi Arabia that is run by Muslim majority or the Muslim religion? How is that idea any different?
It's not. And really, I mean, one of the things that I've been trying to hammer with this book, and with, you know, going on the book tour and talking about this, and the paperback for The Founding Myth just came out this past week, is that this political theology is an existential threat to our republic. And so, you know, I've been saying this for 2 years before the book came out, and I really think on January 6th they proved me right. Right? I mean, and this is why I wrote The Founding Myth. The subtitle is Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. And it's, I think it's pretty rare. I'm not familiar with another case anyway. I think it's pretty rare that you choose a subtitle for a book and then the subject of that runs out to prove you right by assaulting the US Capitol and attempting to overthrow the results of a free and fair election, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's... And one thing that I really tried to do, well, let me put it like this. Christian nationalism is a symptom of the disinformation that plagues America. And the very identity of the Christian nationalist depends on that disinformation. And it's disinformation that you've heard before. It's kind of what I'm getting at with some of these polling questions. People have heard it many times before, that we're one nation under God, that the Declaration of Independence references the Christian God four different times. In God we trust, that the founding fathers prayed at the Constitutional Convention, that George Washington knelt in the snow at Valley Forge and prayed that our law is based on the golden rule, that our laws are based on the Ten Commandments, right? And none of that, none of it is true. But without the historical cover that those lies give, many of their policy justifications begin to crumble. And without their origin myths, their identity begins to wither and fade. So this is the really interesting part of this for me, and it's really why I wrote The Founding Myth, that their entire political and ideological reality is vulnerable because it's based on disinformation. And it becomes clear when you explore the myth and the lies that this truly is an un-American political ideology, right? To get back to your question, it's not just that the identity is based on disinformation, it's bigger than that. It's that the claim that we are founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and especially those principles that are central to the Christian nationalist identity, those principles are thoroughly opposed to the principles on which the United States was built. And so this is the argument that I'm trying to make. This is what I want people to understand, that the two systems differ and conflict in fundamental and irreconcilable ways. So again, to answer your question, let's put it like this. America will never be a Christian nation, because the moment it becomes a Christian nation, it will cease to be America.
Got it. It be less a democracy and more a theocracy, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, the authoritarian streak in Christian nationalism is very potent, very strong, very obvious. And I talk about this a lot in the book. You know, I mean, there's a lot of analogies to be drawn between the tyrannical biblical God and Trump, and the need for, you know, this Christian nationalist need for a strong man, for an authoritarian government.
You know, I see this mirrored in the church I grew up with too, the hierarchy and the way that so many people just kind of took what the pastor said as word, and then it was all really male, straight white male driven too. There was very little room for minorities or women to join in and become a part of the hierarchy as well. So it seems like this model that was taken from the Bible and applied to the church, and then is they're looking to apply it to the United States as well. And if we're not able to, as U.S. citizens, if we're not able to really challenge our government, if our government is not afraid of us, then we living in a, it feels like a dictatorship almost, or if I'm not mistaken.
No, I mean, we're slouching towards authoritarianism at the very, very least right now. I mean, I'm deeply concerned about what the future holds for the United States. And I am concerned because of the success that Christian nationalism has had. You know, I mean, Trump, January 6th goes like a couple different ways, a couple different seconds, a couple different ways. And everything is different. I mean, you know, the new information that we have coming out about the memo that's been circulating. You know, one thing that I have been doing since January 6th, and I did this for the epilogue for the Founding Myth, is I've been scouring the photos and the videos and the court cases. And, you know, just dipping your toe into this world is so alarming. But I've immersed myself in it, and I am more convinced now than ever before about the role that Christian nationalism played in assaulting our democracy. And there were a lot of different identities at the Capitol that day, right? There were white nationalists, mm-hmm. there were militia groups, there were Second Amendment groups, there was the QAnon folks. But the thing that tied all of that together in a nice bow, the unifying factor among all of those, was the Christian nationalism. And you can see that thread, right? Like, but if you look not that closely at the KKK and other white nationalist groups, they're explicitly Christian. There's a very strong element of QAnon in the evangelical churches in the United States now. And there's been study after study that's popping up showing that there's this pretty clear link between those two. If everybody remembers the New Yorker video that was shot in the Capitol that day, which actually shows the insurrectionists praying in the Senate, right? I mean, I think people kind of have forgotten about this a little bit, but you know, one attacker carried a Christian flag onto the floor of the Senate, and the absurdly self-proclaimed QAnon shaman led a prayer about patriotism and Jesus and restoring the nation, and he ended it in Jesus' name. And I mean, it's typical of Christian nationalism. The Proud Boys knelt in prayer on their march to the Capitol about, and they prayed for restoring our nation. Again, that's typical Christian nationalist rhetoric. One of the praying insurrectionists said, you know, we got into the Senate and we, quote, consecrated it to Jesus. That to me is the ultimate statement of where we are in this movement. And he's right. It is the ultimate statement of where this movement is. So I mean, the evidence of the Christian nationalism that day is irrefutable, I think. And that's what I get into in the new epilogue for the paperback of the Founding Myth. And I've got a new project that is going to drop really close to the anniversary that this is all I can say about it, that I think is going to really blow people's minds with the showing the Christian nationalist influence that day.
Well, you know, none of this could have really happened without a very basic foundation of myths and mythology. What say we kind of go into that and talk about some of the myths that are at the basis of this ideology and see if they hold water or anything like that.
Sure. Which one do you want to do first? Do you have a specific one that you want to get into?
That, you know, the thing that I hear the most is that when I was having discussions with people is that our founding fathers were all Christian, and they based the Constitution off of biblical principles.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is right. This is what I get into in the founding. So the founding myth, I'm not actually arguing against the idea that we're a Christian nation in the founding myth. What I wanted to go deeper than that, because I think it's pretty easy to push back against that idea. So I argue against the idea that the United States was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, right? Whatever that phrase, it's a little little waffly might mean. That's the argument that I take on in the founding myth. And that's how I show that there's this kind of fundamental irreconcilable difference between the two, right? I'm going at the deeper argument that they tend to fall back on once you, you know, quote the Treaty of Tripoli at them when they say that we're a Christian nation. And always, 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 we come back to the founding fathers. And it, let me start off by saying that this is like one of my favorite things to talk about ever. And if we were at a real life bar instead of our virtual speakeasy here, you know, you could get me going and like give me a whiskey and like I could pontificate for 8 hours about the religion of the founding fathers or not. It's fascinating. It's so interesting. But I think that we tend to make a mistake when we engage on this question, because fascinating though it is, it actually doesn't matter.
And so it's a red herring.
It's not a red herring in the sense that we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because by engaging on the question, we are admitting that the answer is important. And it's not, because I can concede for the sake of argument that all of the founding fathers were Bible-believing, Jesus rose from the dead Christians, and that doesn't tell you anything about what principles they used to build a nation up. It doesn't tell you about what they wrote into the Constitution or into the Declaration of Independence or into the Bill of Rights or what the Federalist Papers say, right? You still have to point to a Christian principle that positively influenced the founding of the United States of America. And I would go even further than that. I would say you have to point to a principle that is unique and original to Christianity, that positively influenced the founding of the United States of America. And they can't do that.
That's fantastic. Unique to Christianity. What is unique to Christianity? Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. And so that's really that if they want to prove that we are a Christian nation or that we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles, that is what they have to prove. So when we talk about the founding fathers and the fact that, you know, George Washington never took communion when he went to church. He never knelt publicly in prayer. He didn't say, "So help me God," when he took the presidential oath. When he died at his deathbed, he refused to have any religious consolation, even though it took him like almost 48 hours to die. Right? Those are not the actions of a Christian or a Bible believer. Right? But it doesn't matter. Because we know that when they debated the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention, and when they defended the Constitution writing the Federalist Papers, they didn't talk about the Bible or Christianity at all. In fact, it's like a pretty conspicuous absence that pissed off quite a few Christians at the time. So, you know, I think we do ourselves a little bit of a disservice. Like, it's super fun. Thomas Jefferson took a razor to the Bible, y'all. And we like to say that he cut out all the supernatural stuff, but that's actually not right. What he did was cut out the stuff that wasn't supernatural, because that was easier. And he pasted it into a different book. And then he said, this is like pulling diamonds out of a dunghill. Like, Thomas Jefferson called the Bible a pile of shit. And I mean, that is pretty amazing. And it's great. And hey, like, that really speaks to our side of the argument. But it doesn't actually get us anywhere. Though that one you can argue, like, he's kind of saying that Christian principles, at least from the Bible, are not so great. So maybe it does get us somewhere. But the point being, we ought to rethink engaging on this. And the other reason to not engage on that is because there's quotes to be had on every side of this issue, right? Like, you can find somebody saying something that supports whatever you want when it comes to the founding fathers. We have so much of what they wrote, so many of their private letters, so many of their personal letters. They wrote for different purposes. They often wrote letters to each other knowing that they would be published later on. That was part of the purpose of what they wrote. Mm. So they
had that forethought.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's, wow. They did things like, I mean, even at the time, knowing that it would be published at the time, it was a sort of a common technique among them. And it, like, also their beliefs change, right? Like, George Washington didn't believe the same thing at 17 as he did at 37, as he did when he was on his deathbed, right? Like, people's beliefs change. So you get, you know, a George Washington quote from when he's 15, it's not going to be the same as when he's on his deathbed. So I think we do a disservice when we engage on this. And we also need to be really careful too, because as everybody knows, Abraham Lincoln told us you have to be very careful about quotes you read on the internet.
Wait a minute. So if somebody comes to me and we have this discussion, we have and he starts off the conversation like, yeah, of course the US is a really as a Christian nation because the founding fathers were all Christian. What would be a good response to that? Like, I'm trying to make it simplistic and it's a long conversation, but
it is. I mean, I think the question is, well, if I prove that they're not Christian, then does that mean that it's not a Christian nation? You have to address the underlying assumption in that argument first. Thomas Jefferson designed Monticello. They all had gardens and they had fields, often worked by slaves. They had outhouses. Is Thomas Jefferson's outhouse a non-Christian outhouse because he sliced up the Bible and then went and built this other thing? No, the two things aren't related. You have to show that his lack of Christianity or his presence of Christianity somehow influenced the building of that outhouse. And you can't do it. And the same thing goes for the country, right? Like, you have to show that their religious beliefs or lack thereof influenced the Constitution. That's the task.
That the real reason he sliced up the Bible, and now that you bring the outhouse up, is because they were tired of using their hand. They were tired of using corn cobs. They needed some paper.
Paper was so valuable. He would not do that. But yes, otherwise, I take your point.
Andrew, I want to play off of that a little bit because I think there are a few different things that, you know, ultimately when people say that this is a Christian nation, right, they point to the same few things. And of course, one of them is that it was founded that way. And, you know, you can debunk that in a various number of ways. But another one that you hear is, well, look at our coinage.
Yeah.
In God we trust. And could you explain that part of this myth, how that got there, and whether that has anything at all, in fact, to do with our founding or the founding of this nation as a Christian one?
Yeah. So, you know, I have a whole part four of the book is, I call it argument by idiom, right? It's American verbiage, and it is in God we trust, one nation under God. So help me God. And I have to say, like, I was actually very annoyed and bitter that I even had to write this part of the book because the arguments are so bad. Like, I'm just offended at the laziness of these arguments, trying to come in here and prove that we were founded as a Christian nation, but none of these things are from the founding of the country. I mean, like, that alone should just end the argument, but for some reason it doesn't. And these are among the most popular rejoinders that you hear when you are having one of these arguments, one of these debates. So I think it is really necessary to address them. And so I really do this in the book. And what I try to do in the founding myth is show not just that these phrases come from a completely different time, that they couldn't have influenced the founding, but that they are actually betrayals of the founding ethos. These are relics left behind by previous waves of Christian nationalism. So the people citing them are undermining their own position if we know how to go about arguing that. So that's how I try to arm people in the book. I try to give you those arguments. And part of the way to do that is to tell the story. And it really, I mean, you know, In God We Trust on Our Coins, it's kind of a fascinating story. So it's the middle of the Civil War. Brothers are killing brothers. Families are being torn apart. The country is being torn apart, literally. And a preacher a preacher named Mark Watkinson writes to the Secretary of the Treasury, a guy named Salmon Chase, who had previously would later try to get the Constitution amended to include Jesus Christ in the preamble. Which is also a total betrayal of our founding ethos, right? We the people.
Yeah.
Let's just do a side note right there, because we the people is like a pretty goddamn amazing moment in human history.
Absolutely.
You know, to cite our power to say that power, the government's power draws its power from the people, not from a deity. That was the first time that had ever happened. It was the first time that humans had done that, which was really remarkable. Anyway, So
this is compared to where we were fighting against a king, a monarchy, and where the what was said, where the king and the queen and the monarch, the royalty had all the power and not the people. Yeah, this is a complete
defender of the church too and the faith. Right, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
One, and we can talk about why I think we've fallen so far away from separation of state and church, but one reason is because I think it's been so remarkably successful. So anyway, Mark Watkinson, this preacher, writes to Salmon Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, and says, you know, the time is propitious right now because to get the Christian God on our coins and get that, I can't remember the exact word. I have the whole letter in the book. Basically, that infidel lady got us off our coinage. The trust of our people should be declared on our coins, right? So they're actively trying to put their God, their Christian God, on our coins while the nation is literally tearing itself apart and too busy to fight back. And so they write to the director of the Mint, James Pollock, who's also a Christian nationalist, trying to get Jesus added to the Constitution as well. And these three guys are responsible, you know, a preacher, a secretary, and a director are responsible for getting In God We Trust put on our coins. And they backdoored it while the nation was looking the other way. And that was 1863, and then Congress ratified it the next year. And one thing I talk about in the book is how Christian nationalism operates like a ratchet, in that once one of these things is foisted on the country, it is damn hard to get it rescinded, to get it removed. Yeah. And I have to say, like, I think that is a huge detriment. And I think that is one of the reasons that we saw the January 6th attackers so emboldened, right? They have been told their whole lives that this is one nation under God, right? They believe that this is a country that trusts in God. And I mean, I really think that is those erroneous beliefs are validated when they see In God We Trust on our money or on our government buildings, or when they're told as school children that we're one nation under God, or when Congress or your local government body or school board, whatever, opens with a prayer, right? Or when they see a Ten Commandments monument sitting on government property that has right at the top, right? I am the Lord thy God. So the Christian nationalist identity, it draws legitimacy from these artifacts that are left by these previous waves of Christian nationalism that this country has endured. And so these relics are really these disfiguring scars. And our failure to get rid of them is, I think, one of the things that have really emboldened the Christian nationalists. And it's why you see them turning to these trite idioms instead of, you know, actually naming a single principle that the United States was founded on that's unique and original to Christianity.
I think that's right there a pretty great segue to, you know, why.
But one sec.
Go ahead.
One sec. I really like how you're describing this as these are relics of our history, because we started this conversation off talking about the Grand Canyon and how we can tell the history that is layered upon layered upon layered, and we're kind of experiencing the same thing with these relics. I have a 1952 $5 bill, and I can pull out any modern day $5 bill, compare them, and there's no In God We Trust on the 1952 $5 bill. Yep. In the movie Christmas Vacation, the lady, as she's doing a prayer, she starts to do the Pledge of Allegiance, and this is an older lady, probably born in the teens or the 20s. Everybody starts to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and one nation under God. Everybody says that except for this older lady, because she didn't say that until when she went in school. It was, I love these like little, how you're comparing these. I love the comparison between the stratigraphy of history and this in the Grand Canyon and the and our modern day. Man, I am fucking up my words today. All right,
not at all.
Take from it what you will. Sorry about that. Trent, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think every stage of this, like you're saying, at some point these myths are instilled in us. It's a cultural ingraining, it seems, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
So I think for people that don't know or just, you know, have lived this life where this is just what they've always believed. Another question I wanted to ask was like, where all of that come from? And it really seems like to me, and I'd love to ask you a follow-up question later on about this. It really is a fine line between philosophy and the what's actually true here. So I think it seems that it might be helpful, really helpful, to engage in, you know, political philosophy. And then you start to understand the differences, the segregation, it seems, between, you know, why us being a Christian nation wouldn't be true. But that leads to this question of when this all started, it seems like people think that there is a correlation between our laws and the Ten Commandments. That's another seeming a misstep there, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted you to speak to that a little bit, because again, it seems like they're missing something, right? And so what are they missing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and this is, again, this is where the founding myth sort of began. So this is, it's part three of the book. And I talk about how all of the Ten Commandments really fundamentally conflict with our nation's core principles. And, you know, I'm sure, yes, some of the Ten Commandments overlap with criminal laws that prohibit murder and theft and perjury. But if you read the book, you'll see that the biblical manifestation of those laws is actually like pretty damn bad, and not really close to what we're talking about today. And those rules are not exclusive or original to Judeo-Christianity, right? Those are universal human principles that every successful society we know of has adopted. And again, there's really compelling evidence to suggest that the biblical version of those prohibitions didn't apply to anyone but fellow believers. In other words, the biblical version of universal principles was not universal. And one of the short, actually, no, I'm going to make people get the book if they want to do it. You don't have to buy it. Go to the library and get it and read it. But, you know, either way, it's very hard to credibly claim that the biblical iterations of the universal rules influenced the founding. And I'm just going to back up real quick, because the first, if you are presented with this argument, the first thing you have to do is say, well, which Ten Commandments? Because...
Wait, what? What do you mean, which Ten Commandments?
I mean, exactly, which Ten Commandments influenced the founding of the United States, Eric?
I only know of one. Is there more than one? Because
there are many more, as it turns out.
What?
So in fact, in any given Bible, there are four sets of Ten Commandments: Exodus 20, Exodus 34, Deuteronomy 5, and Deuteronomy 27. And then different religions interpret the commandments differently. They number them differently. And you know, they may seem like small differences to us. Right, like I personally don't give a fuck about the difference between a graven image and an idol, but it split the Catholic Church and Christendom in half. They had a civil war about that difference in the 8th and 9th centuries. It's called the Iconoclast Controversy. The difference between not being able to murder and not being able to kill is the difference between being able to protect your family if somebody breaks into your house at night and not. So these are not small differences. And I think there's an argument to be made when you're talking about someone possessing absolute certainty about the ultimate truths of the universe on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, that there's no such thing as a small difference. Now, the other Ten Commandments, right, leave aside the ones that are not, that we already talked about here, are downright un-American. They begin, and I'm talking about the 10 that everybody thinks of, like the Nelson DeMille 10 Commandments, which are not actually called the 10 Commandments in the Bible. The ones that are actually called the 10 Commandments are the ones that end, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Those are the real 10 Commandments. According
there to had them. To be a law about that. Like,
It was a baby goat, Eric. But yes.
Oh, geez.
Even the Bible's not that barbaric, but still, yes.
Of course it is. Like parents can kill their own kids.
100% is. Parents do kill their own kids. Jeff sacrifices his daughter so he can win a battle, right? Yes. No, you're forgiven.
Okay, a baby goat. All right.
Baby goat. Yes.
That's a horrible thing. I'm sorry. Just kind of letting that mother's milk soak in.
That's an image that won't go away now. We already talked about this. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That is how Ten Commandments begin, what people think of as the Ten Commandments. And it's a divine command that embodies principles that directly conflict with the principles on which the United States was founded, right? No law can tell an American to worship a god, let alone which god. We are free to be godless, as a growing number of us are. Or we can worship every god from every holy book if we want. And they really continue, the Ten Commandments continue in this un-American vein. They prohibit free expression and art. That's the graven images or idols. They prohibit free speech, taking the Lord's name in vain. And they sanction slavery twice in Exodus 20, verses 10 and 17. And this is my favorite part because people don't really remember this. And if you look at the monuments that they carved into stone, they tend to leave this out, but I'll get to that in a second. The Ten Commandments, God's most moral law in the whole universe, promised to punish innocent children to the third and fourth generation if their parents are brazen enough to exercise the religious freedom guaranteed in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Right? Like if you try to be free and exercise your religious freedom, God promises to punish your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. That is about as un-American as you can possibly get. And the 10th commandment might even be worse. It condones slavery, it treats women as chattel, and it criminalizes thought. And I know some of you out there are thinking, well, condones slavery and treats women as chattel kind of sounds like it had an influence on the founding of the United States, maybe, right? But yes, again, the challenge for the Christian nationalist is to name a unique and original principle to Christianity that positively influenced the founding of the United States. It's very strange that none of them want to claim the influence Christianity had on slavery or, you know, institutionalized misogyny. Anyway, to take that one little pin out that we stuck in, most of the Ten Commandments monuments that you see on public spaces, they edit out a lot of these more horrific parts, which I just think is just a chef's kiss. Because think about what it means. It means that we humans are using our morality to cut out the immoral parts of the Ten Commandments, including the two mentions of slavery and punishing innocent children. Right. And so, I mean, this is what
are
I'm
you
really
saying that's
at,
like somewhat humanistic of them?
Yeah. I mean, a little bit more editing God's most moral law and etching it in stone with our edits. Right. And this is the comparison between Christianity and the American constitutional system continues like this. I mean, I could list many, many more, and I kind of do in the book, right? The Bible venerates principles like obedience and fear. The Constitution venerates freedom. The Bible teaches you to obey because the rulers, because they were ordained by God. But we the people give the rulers power. And we the people retain not just a right, but also a duty to rebel against totalitarian rulers. The only governments mentioned in the Bible are monarchies and theocratic monarchies at that. There's no whiff of representative government anywhere in that document. Biblical justice is so severe and so vicious that if it were implemented, it would violate the Constitution. Hell, which is a central tenet of Christianity, conflicts with the Constitution on at least two major counts, both as a place of torture and as an eternal punishment. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And the Supreme Court actually said that being locked in a jail cell with a 5-pack-a-day smoker was cruel and unusual. So whatever hell is, I'm sure it qualifies. Original sin, right? That transgresses the core presumption of American justice, the presumption of innocence. I could go on and on like this, and I do in the founding myth. The point that I'm trying to make is that Christianity and Judeo-Christian principles are fundamentally opposed to the principles on which the United States was built. And even if those principles were aspirational at the time, and I fully admit this, and I get into that a little bit more in the book, that conflict is irreconcilable. And that means that there's no possible way you can claim that Christianity influenced the founding of the United States of America. Credibly.
You paint a really clear picture in the way that you're painting the United States and how it was set up is a lot like how I currently see it, but it's not at all what I was taught growing up. And these revisionist histories that I was taught, like the Pilgrims having a great time with the Indians and George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. And I can tell how, if we can make up stories to suit our agenda, that we can have this feeling of immortality and power, just incredible power to do what we want with the power we have.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's really rewarding as an author to hear that your book has helped people or impacted people. But one of the most rewarding things for me about this book is that I've heard from a lot of people who were brought up like that, who were brought up a very cloistered faith, the closed information system that is religion. And they were on two fronts. They were so thankful to have this information and to learn this real history. But the thing that really touched me is that they felt for the first time like they were not an outsider in their own country when they were reading it and understanding what that history was about. And that to me is kind of one of the really big things that I was going for, is that, you know, the true heirs of the American experiment are the free thinkers, are the people who are out there challenging established dogma. When I hear that from folks, that is, I think, for me as the writer, that is like the highest praise that I can hear.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. Thank you. what other myths do you feel like we haven't brought up yet?
Well, I mean, we could do George Washington, and I mean, you know, that one's such a fun one. You know, you mentioned the cherry tree. And so for folks who don't know, that is a myth. George Washington did not chop down a cherry tree and did not tell his dad, I'm very distracted by Gail at the moment, that he...
that he I gotta tell you.
I know. He did not say, I cannot tell a lie. And that myth comes from a guy named Parson Mason Weems. Parson being his title, right? He was an itinerant preacher, basically. And Mason Weems traveled the country, and he wrote these salacious tracts that the whole point was just to sell, right? He just wanted to make money. He did not care about truth or veracity.
What? That doesn't happen nowadays.
No, not at all. No, it's not. There's not an entire media empire named Fox News built on that very premise. And he wrote a tract, and I have been trying to track this down, and as far as I know, it has not survived to us to this day. He wrote a tract about onanism, right? Masturbation and anti-masturbation tract, all kinds of just ridiculous things that he wrote. And when he heard the news that Washington died, he sent this letter that we do have that has survived history to his publisher. And he says, "Washington, you know, is dead." And he has an exclamation point at the end of the sentence. And it's such an obscene punctuation mark in that context. And he writes this hagiography of Washington, and no regard for truth at all. Just trying to do it as quickly as possible, get it out, just all myth making, whatever he thinks people are going to want to read and what is going to sell. And this sounds
so familiar.
I mean, it becomes a runaway bestseller. It was a huge success. And then in the 17th, I believe, edition, which is something like 40 years after Washington's death, maybe not quite that long. I have the exact numbers in the book. He adds this story about Washington kneeling in the snow at Valley Forge and praying during that really awful winter, 75, 76. And it didn't happen, right? There's no evidence. There's no eyewitness. There's no test. Nothing to suggest that it happened. It was made up by this guy who knowingly made up all these things and told everybody that he made up these things and made up the myth about the cherry tree. And yet it has been latched onto as this great moment in American history. There is a stained glass window of it in the US Capitol, right? It's appeared on postage stamps and paintings. And the reason for it is because it takes who he was known even then as the father of our country, in part because, well, I won't get into that, known as the father of our country, and brings him down to this imitable level, right? He's this unreachable, unattainable standard for any public figure. And all of a sudden now the only thing they have to do to be like George Washington is be publicly pious. They have to just show some ostentatious piety, and then all of a sudden they're just like George Washington. And the crazy thing about that is, like, he deliberately shunned all public piety. This is why he didn't take communion when he went to church, whether or not he believed in it. He didn't believe in flaunting that religion in public. So we can be pretty certain he would have hated this myth about him. But of course, politicians love it today, and Christian nationalists love it, because they get to claim that this is their country and they get to be just like him by just being Christian.
We see this so often, and I'm not surprised that it happened after a well-known person died, where an entire movement or an entire group of people sort of rework their lives to suit their own agenda. And it sounds like this is exactly kind of what happened in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
And it just was like a snowball effect, just built and built and built, and here we are.
And then what happened was it started working its way into the McGuffey readers, which were these books that were super popular for school kids. And you know, they need things to, when you're learning to read, you need things to read. And these Weimsian stories and myths made it into the McGuffey readers. And that really sort of solidified it in the American mind and really helped push it out further. And, you know, I mean, the myth that you have to say as a president, so help me God, at the end of the presidential oath, is also stems from another famous American myth maker. Right? Like, if you go read the Constitution, there's only one oath in there, and it's the presidential oath. And it doesn't say the words, so help me God. It ends, I will preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution to the best of my ability, period. There's no so help me God on there. It's the only oath where we have the exact words of what the founders wanted you to say. And we have presidents departing from that now on the regular. It's actually a pretty modern trend, as I explain in the book. But Washington didn't say that. And we know, because everybody standing around him at the time said that he didn't say it. That comes from one of our, let's see, what else did he write? He wrote Rip Van Winkle, The Headless Horseman, you know, all these really interesting pieces of American myth. Washington Irving, he's the one who said that when he was a little boy, he saw Washington taking the presidential oath. And I tell the story in the book. I actually recreated the moment. I went to Federal Hall and I stood where Washington Irving said he was standing. And it's just, there's zero chance that he knows what he was talking about. And it was, again, you know, so 50, 60 years after the actual event that it's being put down in print for the first time. So we know it didn't happen. We know it didn't happen. And yet now we have every president for the last basically 80 years mimicking this myth that didn't happen.
Yeah. You know, I'm seeing, I'm a United States citizen, and so many of us are so engrossed in our own country's politics, but there is this much, much bigger world out there.
Oh, yeah.
And even from the people that I hear, like the international folks, when they kind of look at how we're doing things and how we're treating things, they're just like, they scoff. This is silly. But with with the publishing of your book, have you heard from folks from other countries who can kind of relate to what's been going on in their own country in a similar fashion? Or is this a purely United States phenomenon?
I mean, I'm certainly the myths, obviously, that I'm addressing are. But nationalism has been on the rise globally for sure, and Christian nationalism specifically. Brazil has been dealing with a particularly virulent strain. There have been a number of the Eastern European countries have also been dealing with it. So yeah, it is on the rise everywhere. I mean, everybody's seen Fox News's obsession with Viktor Orban. It's not limited to us. I am, for the most part, tackling it. I will say that in the next book, American Crusade is the current title. I talk a lot more about the nuts and bolts and the alliances that are promoting a lot of these myths and that are trying to weaponize religious freedom and redefine what religious freedom means, and how they are exporting a lot of these hateful agendas overseas and funneling tons and tons of money overseas to do things ban gay marriage, all kinds of terrible stuff. That's actually a mild example compared to some of the stuff they're doing. So yeah, it's a problem.
And this isn't just a Christian specific phenomenon. I know that the Indian government, the party that's in power now,
Modi.
Yes, has been working really hard to make the Hindu myths kind of real and rewrite some of the history and rewrite who the bad guys were at the time too, similar to what the United States has done over its time.
Yep. Yeah, I work with a gentleman named Amit Paul, who is somewhat of an expert on this. He's written pretty extensively about it here in the United States. So he's the director of communications at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And he's got a lot of family back in India and is really been deeply concerned and has done a number of pieces and interviews for FFRF, you know, about this very, very subject. It's alarming.
So this wouldn't be happening if people didn't give the power, if people didn't let it happen. What about this type of nationalism makes people want to have it? I don't get it. Like, the way you're describing it, it sounds awful, but
yeah,
people are wanting it. People are voting for it. People are
I think a lot of people don't realize the danger. So if you look at the stats, okay, so basically the country is chopped up into quarters when it comes to Christian nationalism. About a quarter are hardcore Christian nationalists they're never going to change their mind. And then another quarter are Christian nationalist light, maybe, or they're sympathetic to Christian nationalism. And then you cross the line and you have a quarter of the country who is sympathetic towards, no, we're a secular nation. We're not a Christian nation. That sounds kind of dangerous to me. And then you have a quarter who are like me, who are, you know, actively fighting Christian nationalism, trying to explain this. And, you know, we are not going to convince the hardcore Christian nationalists that they're wrong and to come to our side. But what we can do is convince that middle 50% of the country that Christian nationalism is an existential threat to our republic, and to relegate it back to the fringe whence it came. That is definitely possible. I hold a lot of hope out for that. It's one of the things that I'm out there trying to do every single day. It's why I will readily come on programs and talk about my book. You know, I mean, one way that I like to talk about it, America is a shared idea. And Christian nationalism refuses to share. It excludes non-Christians and the wrong kind of Christians. So again, America will never be a Christian nation, because the moment it becomes a Christian nation, it will cease to be America. The two cannot peacefully coexist. One is going to triumph. And this really is the choice that we face as a nation: Christian nationalism or America, because we cannot have both.
You know, I also have a feeling that if there is some authoritarian in place, like what the aim of Christian nationalism seems to be, that people people have this view that they'll be taken care of better, that they'll be in their own tribe, and it's almost like a xenophobic type of thing too.
I I think that's true too, but I also think it's because they assume it's going to be their tribe,
right,
the whole time, yeah, right? And that assumption underlies it. And if you look at the demographics of Christian nationalism, that's not true, right? There's a whole pretty sizable strain of American Catholicism that has been absorbed into the Christian nationalist movement. And if let's say that Christian nationalism was successful, right, at some point, the Christian nationalist Catholics and the Christian nationalist evangelicals are going to have it out with each other. So, I mean, there are these sort of inherent contradictions in the identity itself.
But there is some comfort in leaving my responsibility at the door and trusting and hoping and thinking that someone who has a direct pipeline to a deity knows better than I do. Like I can of shift course. My responsibility up the ladder some, and that's it seems like a slippery slope and a really it's a top level. It might feel comfortable, but the results are not at all what I think we'd want.
Yeah, you know, you're reminding me kind of in the previous end of the book, before I wrote the epilogue about the January 6th insurrection. You know, I kind of ended the book by, I sort of talked about how we have to shed the trappings of religion to save humanity. You know, if we could ignore the differences among the religions in terms of nomenclature and liturgy, and literature and costume, you know, we might find a few universal truths, such as the golden rule, provided, of course, that we can excise that tribalism along with the pageantry. And I want to be very clear here. This is not because all religion is correct or because all religion worships the same God under different guises, but because all religion is man-made. And there are some universal human principles that the human authors of religion couldn't help but put into their religion. Things like don't steal, don't kill, don't lie, treat others as you'd like to be treated, help those who can't help themselves. But those are not religious principles. And they've been corrupted by religion. Those are universal human principles. And we have to jettison the religious from the humane. So humans need saving, but we need saving from religion.
I'm going to make a t-shirt, jettison the religious. Oh shoot. I totally missed it. I'm going to have to play it back. Make that quote on a t-shirt. That's brilliant.
But with that in mind, Andrew, something I want to ask too is, and you're doing this now on a daily basis, but what are some efficacious methodologies for us to challenge this and to confront this? And I mentioned, you know, a comprehension of political philosophy earlier, because again, how else do you start to dismantle these ideas and deconstruct these myths that, you know, we've grown up with? What are some strategies that you found are helpful in, you know, telling the real story here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a really important question. It's probably the most important question. I mean, the number one thing is that, again, this is an entire identity based on disinformation. And I think that if you recognize that and you are worried about this, you have a duty to oppose that disinformation. That does mean educating yourself. Yes, of course, I would love for everybody to go out and buy a copy of the book, but I want you to learn the information in it. That is more important. Go to the library, get a copy, borrow somebody's copy. That to me is because we cannot let these myths and this disinformation stand unchallenged. I mean, that is a big reason why we are in this mess in the first place, right? We treated this disinformation like it was a scholarly historical debate about the founding instead of this insidious attempt to redefine the American identity. So number one is definitely you've got to learn, and you cannot sit silently by while these lies are being spread. You have to challenge that disinformation. That's probably one of the most important things. I really would encourage everybody to join up with groups like RFR and FFRF, American Atheists, whatever group you feel most calls to you, do that. I think it's really important that we have that institutional base to help fight back, right? I was in meetings on the Hill today with some fairly big offices. And when I can go into those meetings and say, look, I represent 30 people in your district, or 300 people in your district, or 3,000 people in your district, that makes a big big difference. So being a member of those groups is actually really, really important, not just because, you know, we need the money to keep doing the work that we do, but because you need to be joining your voice with ours. But really, I think the number one thing that the average person can do is,
you know, I think, you skipped over like a really good point that the membership of organizations like FFRF isn't just to raise money.
No,
you can also use it as a leverage. Look, this is our, these are the people who are for our mission, who want to see this separation of church and state kept. We have X number. And I had never considered that. I always thought that it was to help raise funds, but you've painted a completely different picture for me.
I can tell you it makes a massive difference for me walking into a congressional office. And, you know, if I say I represent 30 people in your state versus I represent 30,000 people in your state, I mean, that is just a huge difference. I mean, that's a world. That's the difference between somebody playing on their phone while we're talking and somebody sitting up straight and taking a note of every single word you say.
Wow.
It makes a big difference. But I mean, if you're just an average person and all that sounds too much or you're not ready, I totally get that. One of the best things that you can do is come out of the closet as a non-believer. If you can do that safely, I believe that is one of the best things you can do. I say this as a lawyer doing this for a decade, more than a decade now. We are not going to win this fight in the courts. Certainly not the way the courts stand. We're going to win this fight with demographics. We're going to win it in the court of public opinion. So it is so important for us to strip non-belief and free thought and atheism of the stigma that has been deliberately attached to it. And the only way to really successfully do that is to be open about your non-belief. And that to me is just absolutely crucial, because we are nearing a tipping point in this country. Right now, if you ask somebody, you know, what are you in terms of religion, the knee-jerk kind of response is for people to say Christian. And not because they're Christian, not because they go to church every Sunday, not because they go to church every month. Probably most people only go maybe on Christmas, but because they equate Christian with being a good person. And we are very quickly nearing the tipping point where that default is going to flip. And once that happens, the demographic, it's a snowball going down a hill, and the demographics are going to shift more and more and more. And then we are in a real position to take political power and do some real serious long-term good. But that involves people coming out of the closet and also getting politically involved, but one thing at a time.
And with that in mind, I want to jump real quick. Just one last question, Eric, I'm curious about here, and then maybe we can move on to Q&A. But with that in mind, I feel like, you know, sometimes you can't force anyone to do anything, especially when, like you said, that this disinformation has become a part of someone's identity. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what extent that you think that this, all of this, is a desperate ploy, a desperation attempt to retain power by people 100%. Who've had that privilege of power throughout all of our history.
100%. And I get into this really a lot in the new book, but also some in the founding. But they are raging against the dying of their privilege. That is what Christian nationalism is doing right now. They are looking, or I guess not, no, a lot of them are. They're looking out on Sunday mornings, and instead of seeing young, smiling faces looking back at them, they're seeing empty pews. And they can read the demographic studies as well as we can. They know what is coming,
right?
And they are desperately trying to solidify and codify their privilege before they lose power.
And they're
doing a damn good job of it. They're doing a really good job of it. But I don't think we're at the point yet where we cannot recover from it. I still think there's hope.
Good. Yeah, thank you. Hey, Eric, you're on mute.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I think that's a great place to kind of wrap up the discussion. Do you have any, Andrew, do you have any final thoughts or final things that you want to say or that we didn't cover in this discussion?
Well, I guess one other thing I would add too is when you're having these discussions and you're talking about a secular government or a Christian nation, things like that, you know, one of the phrases that I love to repeat, and I would encourage everybody to take it and adopt it, is, you know, there's no such thing as the freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion. And everybody out there who's an American at least professes publicly a love for religious freedom. And if you genuinely care about religious freedom, the only answer to that is a secular government. You should be fighting for a secular government. And if you're not fighting for that, you are simply fighting for your privilege. So again, I mean, there's no such thing as the freedom of religion without a government that's free from religion. Remember that when you're having these conversations, explain that to people, because, you know, I mean, it's another way of saying, right? Like, yeah, but if you weren't part of the majority religion that was in power, you wouldn't be so happy with a religious government, right? Mm-hmm. It tends to land a little bit better and a little less hostile, I have found.
Well, I tend to, you know, when you talk about and you see the hatred of something like Sharia law, yeah, well, that's ironic again to me, because really this is just the Christian version of Sharia. Yeah. That's what happens when you merge your legislation with your religion.
Yeah, you will just get, that is true. You will just get written off pretty quickly by a lot of people that you're trying to convince with that argument, which is why I found it better to adopt that particular phrasing.
Right.
I've market tested it, let me say, right. several times.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on and just talking with us. Really, really appreciate it. This was a fantastic and enlightening. I know that it was US centric too, but I feel like this can also apply to a lot of other countries around the world, as we kind of discussed.
Can I say something that's not US centric then, real quick?
Sure.
I mean, especially for this audience too, you know, I am not religious. I never have been. I didn't grow up religious. I was not, you know, told to go to church. My mom actually insisted that I question everything and that I challenge authority as like a guiding principle, which seems to have stuck given what I do, you know. So I never had to do any deconstruction. I never had to question faith, anything like that. But I just admire the hell out of people who can do that. I am so astounded by people who have the intellectual honesty and courage and fortitude to examine your most deeply held beliefs, and not even just to examine, but to challenge and reject those. But I am so impressed by your ability and your journey. You know, that to me is just one of the most amazing things, and you have all my support and love for being able to do that.
Beautiful.
Thank you. That I'm sure is going to be very humbling to a lot of people in this chat, myself included. So thank you. That's very gracious and kind of you to say. And again, we're lucky and fortunate to have you here too, and just drop us with these like total mic drops of wisdom that you've had tonight.
I really mean it. I mean, that journey is what gives me hope for our species, you know, for humanity. And I hate, there's a lot of atheists out there who, you know, like to paint believers as I don't know. I'm not even going to get into that, but you know, I don't even know. I like to think that I would have had the intellectual fortitude and honesty to make that same journey, but I could not say with any confidence that I would have had that if I had been in the same situation. Sure. I think you should just be damn proud of having the fortitude and courage to do that. Bravo.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I think that validates a lot of people who've been going through this, and because I see it the same way. It's incredibly courageous to work to being your true self when you lose this faith. So well said.
It really is.
Trent, you want to take a question? We can move on to the Q&A and take the first one.
Absolutely. We've got just a handful here, Andrew, and I'll hit you with what we got. One of them has already been answered, I think, a little bit when you said you were never raised religious, because that was one of the questions. So, but I will ask you here, and there was a little bit of a discussion going on about this in the chat, and it's, why has the religious right been able to hold a monopoly on AM radio, talk radio. And now you even see it in podcasts and things like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Tom Nichols wrote a book called The Death of Expertise that talks quite a bit about that. And I got into this for a chapter in the new book and I ended up sadly cutting the chapter. But I think there's a lot to be said for the fear and rage that is conservatism in the United States, and that it translates very well to that medium. People essentially, I say this coming from a neuroscience background, right? You become addicted to that feeling of rage. And Seth Andrews wrote in his book, his Fox News Christian book, he wrote that, you know, he talks about how he was going through this, and he kind of felt this addiction, and he's got these great lines, and I'm going to blow the imagery a little bit, and I apologize to Seth, but you know, if you cut open his head and looked at his brain, you would see a red, white, and blue goo mix. And he's right. Like, it actually has an effect on your neurochemistry. And I think that it's only one type of American politics and religion really lends itself to that, and the other side doesn't. And I think that is there's a biological answer to this. I may end up publishing that in book number three, so I'm not gonna talk more about it until I get there. But I think there might be biology. And I will say too, my mom said, I went to a bar mitzvah when I was 11 or 12. And apparently after that, I did say I wanted to be Jewish because it was the most fun I'd ever had at a party in my life. So take that for what you will.
There you go.
Got another question here. Is it appropriate for public school teachers to discuss atheism with their students? I mean, I would imagine that really depends on the context, but what do you think?
So the lines for public school teachers are essentially they can teach about religion, but they can't preach religion as objective truth. They can educate about religion, but they can't indoctrinate into a religion. Teach but not preach, educate but not indoctrinate. And the same goes for atheism as well. So it does depend on context. It depends on the age of the students. It depends on, you know, whether or not they were reading a novel that touched on godless themes. I think Holden Caulfield might be an atheist in Catcher in the Rye. There are certainly times when that can come up, just like they can talk about Christianity and Christmas and all that kind of stuff. We do get a lot of complaints at the Freedom From Religion Foundation about teachers that cross the line. No real complaints that I can ever recall about an atheist teacher, oddly enough. if you think maybe this happened in your kid's school, for instance, or something like that, and you are concerned, I would really encourage you to go to the FFRF website, ffrf.org. There's a legal tab, and you can report a state church violation, and you'll hear from one of our attorneys usually within a day. And if you can provide as much information up front, we'll be able to give you a better answer, but we'll work with you to determine whether or not it is a violation and then what steps we might take to correct that violation. And working with you to do that. And most importantly, to protect your identity.
So a teacher may be opening the conversation with, some people believe X, instead of saying, you know, atheist is the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, those are good examples of what's okay and what's probably not okay. Yeah.
Perfect. Trent, you got another one?
Got another one here for you. And I would say that it's, by you being here, probably pretty patently untrue, but is it political suicide to come out against the Christian right, basically? And how do you overcome that hurdle? You know, I guess, do you just submit that there's going to be people that will, like you said, follow you around, right? As trolls or as haters, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two questions wrapped up in there in a way. I mean, first, I think, well, let me say like this first. For the Christian nationalists, if you are not one of them, you are against them. So it doesn't actually matter whether or not you come out against them, because they're gonna go after you just as hard whether you're with them or not. So you may as well do the right thing. But I also, I got a little vibe from that question, whether or not you can kind of come out as an atheist and win public office in this country. And I, you know, the answer to that is untested. And that's one of the reasons I think that it's so important for people to come out of the closet now. You are able to, you're providing that cover and making it politically palatable. The numbers, I've written about this for Religious Dispatches, the numbers in the last few elections are really heartening in terms of the share of the electorate that is the nuns. We are seeing some really good movement there, and pretty soon I think it's going to be not politically favorable to pander to religion. And the next step after that will be that it's actually politically harmful to pander to religion. So we're making progress, but again, that depends on people coming out of the closet and building that support system for everybody else to be able to.
Excellent. Thank you.
So here in the US right now, there are, and I would say Christian nationalists are challenging and working to take away a woman's bodily autonomy or right to bodily autonomy. And the abortion question is up to the Supreme Court, and we're waiting to hear from them. The question is, what odds do you give that the Satanic Temple, who is expressing their religious freedom to have abortions, what odds do you give that the Satanic Temple will win their RFRA abortion exemptions? And I forgot what RFRA stands for, Religious Freedom.
The Religious Freedom Restoration Act is RFRA. It's essentially the same as the First Amendment for our purposes of our discussion here. Though in American Crusade, I get into the whole difference in the fun and the history of RFRA and all that next year, folks. This question is based, and this challenge is based on the idea that our courts are guided by legal principle,
yeah,
and doctrine and the Constitution. And if they were, the challenge wouldn't be necessary in the first place, because reproductive choice is the law of the land. It is a constitutional right, and it would not be under threat. So and if you're talking about this in the long run, going to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court weighing in on it, very, very low, low, low chances. The Supreme Court is not guided by legal principle. This is a broken partisan body. Three of the justices litigated the Bush versus Gore case. Seats were stolen to put these justices on the Supreme Court, right? Like Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump and Leonard Leo at the Federalist Society, right? They didn't do all of this hard work to get these people on the Supreme Court just so they could have just impartial jurists who are just going to, just their friends who just happen to be impartial jurists, right? They put ideologues on the court to guarantee outcomes. That is why they did this, and they're getting it. I mean, this Roe versus Wade is gone. It's gone.
Yeah. I've heard that our current many members of Supreme Court justices, it's currently called like an activist court, where they're trying to pursue or push this Christian nationalist agenda that we've been talking about.
No, the Freedom From Religion Foundation released a report in December, and we're updating it quarterly, about the Christian nationalist influence on the judiciary. And we go over the numbers and show pretty unequivocally that there is a massive Christian nationalist influence in the judges that Trump and McConnell put on the court, all the way up through the Supreme Court. It is a real serious problem, and it's going to affect absolutely every single thing that we want to do as a country in the future. I mean, you know, really for me lately, everything kind of begins and ends with Supreme Court expansion. And I just wrote an op-ed about this for The Progressive that's been picked up and published elsewhere. That's why I have so many trolls following me around these days, explaining why this is such a problem. I mean, whatever issue you care about, whatever it is, from climate change to voting rights to racial equality to LGBTQ equality, I mean, all of this goes to the Supreme Court. And Roe versus Wade is going to be struck down. They may leave it up in name, There's kind of a healthy debate going on right now about that. It doesn't matter because women aren't going to be, Texans aren't, Americans aren't going to be able to get an abortion. But after that, they're not going to be done. They're not done when they do that. They're coming for contraception after that. And if you think that's hyperbole and I'm crazy, go back and look at the Hobby Lobby case from 2014, right? It's not. In that case, the Supreme Court said, look, you believe that these pills cause an abortion. They totally don't, but you believe it, so get them out of here. And they're coming for gay marriage after that. They're coming for marriage equality. And this is why I have been screaming for the past 2.5 years that we need Supreme Court expansion and reform now. We need it now. Anyway. All right. That was a downer of a question.
Yeah. Well, we got one more. Man.
Is it a happy question?
Yeah, no, well, happier it's not. Than that. Here's a question about...
Wait, hang on. Let me just... I saw somebody say court packing is a really bad idea in the chat. The court is already packed, okay? If you are arguing against court packing, you are fighting a one-sided battle. This is what I'm talking about. They didn't take these seats. They already packed the court. It's already been done.
Right. Yeah, so we have here just a question on liability, really. It says, what penalties are there for people or governments who break the church-state separation rules? And, you know, I think it's probably a question of what rules are in place and which rules are actually enforced, because it seems like...
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really fun question. And it's something that in a better political climate, I have big plans for. But the answer is pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
Right, like you're not going to jail if you right. violate the First Amendment as a public official. The worst that's going to happen is that your government is going to have to fork over a lot of money to the other side to pay their attorney's fees.
Right.
You know, I billed out at a case that I won against the California school district. That's something like $700 an hour, and I don't want to take that money from a school district. Kim Davis's county, the county that she worked for, paid the ACLU's attorney's bills because they lost the case and she was a county employee. That was what the whole case was really about, right? There's not a lot of incentive, we'll say, for public officials to toe that line if they think there's a political incentive to not, right. Which is a big part of the problem.
Right. Well, on that note, let's all like slip into a nihilistic, you know, sadness and pull our Kleenex. But there's a lot of work to be done, and it's got to be done if we're gonna.
I'm still in this fight, right? If I thought it were hopeless and that we could not win this, I would not be spending my...
You'd be moving to Canada.
Yeah, I would not be... I wouldn't be spending my evenings doing this. I wouldn't be writing op-eds screaming about this. I believe we can still win this fight. Absolutely, I believe it. But it is going to take a lot more people speaking up and standing up.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you so much for shedding some light onto this. Really, really appreciate it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.